And friends, you're listening to the Flannelly Show live on irishradio.com worldwide. I would like, before as we head up to Quinnipiac University in, of course, New Haven, Connecticut, I'd like to tell you a little bit about our guest. Mary Corcoran, PhD. She's a graduate of University of Dublin, Trinity College, Columbia University, a professor of sociology at Maynooth University. And as I welcome Dr. Mary Corcoran, who is indeed working along with Christine Keneally, historian, founder the Irish Great Hunger Institute at Quinnipiac. Mary, you're very welcome indeed.
Oh, thank you very much, Adrian, for having me on.
You know, you came at a time. You might describe to us, and particularly what the role of a Fulbright scholar. First, by the way, first ever to be welcomed to Quinnipiac University. I wanted to throw you an easy question just to get
Well, the Fulbright program is this wonderful opportunity that is given to academics in America to go out around the world and spend a period of time in another country, and likewise for academics scattered around the globe to come and spend some time in America. So it was set up, I think, by I guess he was a senator, Fulbright, and I think after the war, to really try and give people, and particularly to give Americans an understanding of cultures abroad, but also to give people around the globe an understanding of American culture. So I as you already mentioned, I was lucky enough to do my doctorate in America, in New York, in the 1980s. So it was a great opportunity for me to come back for a short period, a semester, and spend some time in America, interacting with Americans, and also doing some research. So it's a wonderful opportunity. I'm very grateful to Quinnipiac University, and particularly to Professor Christine Keneally, who was my sponsor. And so, you know, she was the one who gave me the invitation to come and spend some time here.
Now, you had mentioned, of course, that your arrival and your time towards, indeed, your doctorate here in New York City at Columbia University happened to be in the 80s. So in addition to your in-depth research, if you looked out the window during that period of time, that was perhaps the highest level of immigrants, the wave that started, again in the 80s, and in particular from Ireland.
It was a very, it was very interesting when I came to America to do my doctorate. I didn't have any preconceived notions about what I would do, but the second summer after, I had registered at Columbia, I started working in a restaurant in Manhattan, and I just couldn't believe everybody working there was Irish. And every evening they would head, or every night after the shift, they would head up to Boston or out to Queens, to these burgeoning new urban Irish communities full of young Irish people. And so, in a way, my topic presented itself to me through that, because I decided, with the support of my supervisor, that I would focus on the undocumented Irish, and that's what I wrote about. And the book that I published in way back now, in 1993, basically looked at, you know, the experience of Irish who, on the one hand, were undocumented, and therefore, you know, were in a very difficult position in the sense that they didn't have the legal right to be in the country, so they couldn't be sure of the security of a job that they had. They couldn't be sure that they would receive appropriate medical attention if they had an accident because, again, they didn't have the documentation. But at the same time, because of the strength of the Irish-American community and the legacy of, you know, the roles that Irish-Americans have played in trade unions, in organizations like Catholic Charities and so on, the Irish undocumented actually were in a lot better position than other undocumented groups. You know, they had access to an ethnic network. There were ways of kind of getting around the system so that they could get gainful employment. Catholic agencies assured them that they would get treatment if they needed help and so on. So I ended up kind of arguing that in some ways the Irish were a privileged group within that group of undocumented. I mean, we see now the way in which the kind of discourse in Washington about people on a caravan coming towards America from South and Central America, you know, basically economic migrants saying that they need and want opportunities. And that's a world away from the experience that the Irish had in the 1980s in New York, who were effectively undocumented as well, but because they were Irish, because they spoke English, because they were educated, because they were white, effectively, they were not really treated in the same way, and they certainly weren't seen as a problem in the way in which undocumented migration is considered a problem now.
There, of course, if we go back to the 80s, there, that wave of undocumented immigrants coming from Ireland, somehow, we won't say entitlement, but the Irish coming here were coming to an America that rightly or wrongly was considered to be the builders of America. Those who had come, again, no more welcome than the caravan that, you know, that Washington appears to be worried about. They didn't have to face the barbed wire. So, yes, they were here. But as you probably, even while you were studying this and, you know, moving towards your doctorate on this topic, what was your own feeling with respect to how somehow the Irish immigrant at the time was somewhere in the back of their heads and in ours too, said, you know something? Something has to happen here. Look at the benefits of having these young Irish educated, hardworking people. You know, you mentioned that you worked in a restaurant during that period. So many of the reason that we saw so many Irish undocumented in a restaurant, in construction, in you know, the areas was somewhat akin to, you know, the wave of immigrants, the Polish people, the Eastern Europeans, who would, in fact, you know, down the road be actually coming into Ireland itself. Can you draw some, you know, comparisons?
Sure, yeah, yeah. I mean, basically, you know, I mean, the Irish who came over in the 80s, they were leaving a country where there was high unemployment, but to be honest, quite a lot of them had jobs, but they felt very constrained. You know, there was not much of an opportunity structure. And for them, you know, there was an element of adventure involved in going off to another country. And obviously, migrants always end up in those sectors where the work is often difficult, dirty, the kind of jobs that maybe the, you know, resident population would prefer to avoid. So as you rightly said, a lot ended up in construction, in the hospitality sector, and also maybe childminding and stuff. And if you come to Ireland today, you see a very similar kind of process. I mean, one of the largest non-Irish group in Ireland now are Polish people, 122,000 of them in the last census. Now, the reason they came to Ireland was largely because the opportunity structure in Ireland in the 2000s was much better than in Poland. So they came to Ireland, and many of them, again, would, like the Irish in New York in the 80s, have worked in jobs that were below their level of qualifications. Now, for the Poles, there would have also been a language barrier. But if you came to Ireland today, you would see that, you know, there's a lot of people in the hospitality sector, waitressing, bartending, etc., that are either East European or indeed from other countries. Brazilians are actually quite a significant number now in Ireland. And the Poles, Lithuanians, Latvians would have all gone into construction work exactly at the point of the Celtic Tiger when construction was going through the roof. So it's a kind of a combination of, you know, a perception of a lack of opportunity in your own country and a perceived opportunity in another country. So there was lots of attractive openings for the Irish in New York in the 80s. There was lots of opportunities for Poles, Lithuanians, etc. in Ireland in the mid-2000s. And so, you know, you can see a kind of a parallel, if you like, experience between the two there. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
actually,
yeah,
by the way, just as a postscript to that, and this again shows this circulation of workers in global space, because I was up this summer, before I started my work here in New Haven, I went on a little holiday to Cape Cod and Nantucket. And what we discovered was, and what our Irish-American Airbnb host said, that in the 80s and 90s, she used to have loads of Irish students working there in the summer. And her house would be full of Irish students working as waitresses. But now it's all East Europeans and very few Irish working on Nantucket or in Cape Cod. And so what that shows is, you know, the Irish have sort of moved on again, and the East Europeans have come in there now in their place. So, you know, this is just something that we have to accept, that there's a kind of a global economy of opportunities and then people moving to where they see the opportunities.
Okay, I want to put the cat amongst the pigeons here for a moment. There is spoke indeed of, you know, how advantaged compared to others the Irish were here, and yes, got great help through the Catholic Church, and I was privileged indeed myself to be a co-founder of Project Irish Outreach at Catholic Charities here in New York. Now, there was, and I suppose always will be, that burst of energy in our genes, that even when we have the edge, like, again, hey, here's the Catholic Church, their influence and all the rest of it, wait a minute, that's not enough. We need to organize ourselves. And if you, you know, the Irish immigration reform movement, the advent of, you know, the Emerald Isle, so many others. Of course, the Ancient Order of Hibernians. We had, nothing was handed to us as an ethnic group. We saw that somehow our history in the United States was being ignored. And in fact, you know, what the hell is going on here? And it took guts. And it also took, you know, the impetus of the young people who were coming here, because a lot of, one would have imagined that the established Irish-American community here would have been thrilled to bits to have their relatives, to have the, you know, the youth of Ireland come over and so forth. They were a different breed. These are not immigrants coming from Ireland, like myself, that were, you know, beholding to a community here that in with tremendous love and generosity had, you know, in many cases they were sponsoring people here because it was somebody's kid, you know, always take care of the neighbor's kid.
Sure, sure.
But, you know, having said that, it's not as if the next generation, as we refer to it, that the expectations from the established community here, that, you know, that they would come over and that indeed they would, you'd see them in droves at Sunday Mass or, in fact, at Thanksgiving and Christmas. There was an expectation that the least they could do would be to, you know, roll in to this Irish-American tradition. And they didn't. And, you know, they were selecting partners and moving in and the you know, whatever.
Oh, you mean the more recent immigrants did have not assimilated, if you like,
not
into the Irish-American community. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think, you see, the thing about it is, like, ethnic groups and that sort of ethnic identity, it's really configured around, you know, need. So when people really needed each other in order to gain advancement, they stuck together, they, you know, they lived in the same circles, they shared the same kind of common ground. And you've mentioned those things there, you know, the Catholic Church being very important, the sense of being associated with particular organizations that remind people of home and so on. But, like, the fact of the matter is, Adrian, like, the world has just changed so dramatically for, you know, the most recent generation of immigrants. And even the use of the term immigrant in relation to Irish people is probably a little bit misplaced in the sense that, I've used the term already, you know, people circulate, they move around in global space, but they can remain connected to their home place. And I think for the generation of Irish that came in the 80s, more than any previous generation, they were able to retain their own identity with home. Many of them went back, which was not part of the Irish migratory tradition. So many went back in the 90s, or else re-emigrated somewhere else. I think they didn't put down roots in the Irish-American community because maybe, you know, and what it is to be Irish has changed a bit. Some of the things that would have been important, like, you know, religiosity or whatever, maybe aren't so important to newer generations of people. And also, when people become educators and you know, have a lot of educational credentials, they move in, they don't need to depend on their Irishness or their Irish credentials in order to gain access to the labor market. They can do it on their own steam, if you like. They become kind of more individual entities. And so, I mean, it's a very complex picture, but I think, you know, the strength of the Irish-American community is really, it's the outcome of a particular set of social and historical circumstances that prevails, particularly in America in the 20th century. But I think in the 21st century, things have shifted a lot. And that you would, that, you know, I think, say, the Irish who are going out to Australia now, I wouldn't expect them to become Irish hyphenated Australians. You know, there's no requirement to give up your identity. There's no requirement to do that. At the same time, let's face it, that the, you know, one of the things that we see from the current migration figures is that people leaving Ireland are about 20% of them, one-fifth are going to the so-called rest of the world. And that is countries other than America, UK, EU, Canada and so on. So we don't, you know, it's become highly diversified as to where Irish people go, and that's why now you have GAA clubs popping up in Dubai and in Singapore. So we still do bring something of our culture with us, but it's diffusing much further, and maybe that's diluting then what is there in America.
I want you to just bridge the reality of the young Irish undocumented coming to the United States, and then, you know, returning in the 90s. How much better had Ireland progressed that they would be, in fact, enticed to go back? And how much of it is, you know, a bit of the Grand McCree, the longing, you know, to come home, the uncertainty when they were leaving, or perhaps they had their minds made up, as in fact we did in our generation, especially if we were leaving, not wanting to face, the terminal, reality of permanent immigration. We kind of fooled ourselves and says, you know what we'll do? We will go over, we'll get skills, we'll save some money, and we'll come back. And that's it. Now, so was some of that, you know, a layover into the 90s when these young people in particular, we're going back not only single, but in many cases now they had, excuse the expression, they had hooked up, and now they're going back to an Ireland that wasn't that much better than they left in the first place.
Well, I mean, basically, again, I would just emphasize that it goes back to your perception of your opportunity structures. The people that I interviewed who came back, well, first of all, they looked at Ireland, they thought there was opportunities again in the 90s. There were jobs. There was a campaign run by the government to try and get graduates to come back. Ireland had turned some kind of corner. Economically, it was on the up. But the main reason that people expressed for coming back to Ireland was, if you want to say it, Grand McCree, it was about a real sense of a need to connect with family and community. And those two things are hugely important to Irish people. It's very interesting that the survey that's been done by NYU and Ted Smith and Marion Casey on Irish Americans, that's one of the findings that comes out of it, is the importance for people of family and community. And the main reason that Irish Americans would visit Ireland is for family. Now, what I'm saying to you is that for a lot of Irish people who came in the 80s and in the 90s, like you say, gotten married, having kids, they're looking at their children and going, where's the best country in the world to raise kids? It's Ireland. I want my children to have the kind of childhood that I had, to know who their grandparents are, their aunts and uncles and so on. And that was a huge thing. It was kind of like a quest for going back and anchoring yourself in Irish culture. Now, some of them were a bit, you know, they came back, they got jobs and so on, but they were a little bit surprised at how developed Ireland had become and that it looked much more like the kind of New York or London that they were leaving. In other words, that it had become much more fast-paced, house prices that were already going up, you know. So it was, people did see difficulties. Now, what's interesting about Irish migration is that after the crash in 2007, we saw a huge increase in people leaving. And by the way, one thing we should note is that Irish people always leave. Some number of people emigrate, leave Ireland every single year, even during the boomiest boom years. People in the age group 18 to 25 were still leaving Ireland. But what happened after 2007 and the economic crash was that went right up through the roof. It almost went back to the 80s levels of Irish people leaving. And everybody was, you know, extremely upset and sad about that. But at the time, I predicted that if the opportunity structure improved in Ireland, they would come back. And I'm happy to report that this very year, April 2018, the number of Irish people coming back to Ireland as opposed to leaving has actually been positive. It's been, you know, more people, Irish people, have come back than have left. And that's the first time that's happened since 2009. So, again, that shows that, you know, this notion of my emigration as very fluid and flexible, and people leaving spending time away, coming back, maybe leaving again, coming back, changing the, you know, destinations that they're going to. So it's a very much a situation in flux. And the other thing to say is that a lot of the outward migration from Ireland now, so when you look at the figures and it says, well, people are leaving Ireland and they're going to Poland and Czechoslovakia, that's not Irish people going to those countries. It's people who came to Ireland in the early 2000s, spent 10 years working, saving, sending money back home, and are actually now returning, repatriating back home. So that's another kind of comparison between the Irish and the East Europeans.
Okay, let's again return to what is now your day job in Quinnipiac University, where indeed it's no harm to point out that the when you speak of Quinnipiac University, a lot of people will, you know, rattle off as, you know, Irish universities, you know, in Notre Dame, whatever. But I think that as we see John Leahy, president, Irish-American, president of Quinnipiac University after more than 31 years leading and growing a small little dinky, you know, suburban university, making it into, you know, a huge anniversary or university that is known worldwide. That the Irish that the commitment, you know, for the Irish, that here's a lady, an Irish American, who looks at the history of the Irish, who looks at the total picture of the Irish, and for the first time in America, you know, instead of those who are wondering what the hell was happening with immigrants here coming back and forth, and again, many of them staying here and delighted with the opportunity to be here. Leahy decided that there were issues that heretofore were taboo. And where did we come from? Where did Irish America grow from? It grew from need. It grew out of the famine. It grew out of the hunger. And it grew out of, you know, the refuge that America indeed offered and posed at the time, despite the fact that a lot of those who came from Ireland and came from other countries, but particularly from Ireland, were about as welcome as the caravans that are coming from.
It's always good to take that long historical view that, you know, I actually just visited the Tenement Museum in New York last week, and I did the tour with the which focused on an Irish American family, and I was shocked at the caricatures of Irish women housemaids in mid 19th century New York, because, like, I'd seen a lot of the images, you know, the stereotypical images of kind of animal-like Irish men, but I'd never seen that done to women as well in American culture. So, yeah, so with a lot of prejudice, a lot of stereotypes, it was very difficult for the Irish. But in a way, I mean, you know, you're absolutely right. The famine was a kind of, in a way, it was a world historical event in the sense that it set in motion a set of factors, including the massive migration of 1 million people from that small island to America, which in a way has changed the role of Ireland in the world, because, you know, we're a small island with 4.8 million people in the Republic, but with, you know, 40 million people who claim some kind of Irish descent. And that's a direct outcome of the famine and the expulsion of people off their land because of the particular kind of colonial policies and political economy that was pursued by the British. in Ireland back then. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's a great achievement that Quinnipiac has been able to establish an institute, and particularly with someone of Christine Keneally's pedigree at its helm, to, you know, remind us that we should always look back as well as look forward and try to make connections between things that happened in the past and the present. And that's what I'm trying to do, actually, during my Fulbright here at New Haven, that, you know, the Great Hunger Institute, you know, is interested in the impact of famine in Ireland and looking at that historically. But famine in Ireland was about food insecurity, and it was about political decisions that were made that left people, you know, in an insecure food position. And what we know is that today in the United States, regrettably, a significant proportion of people live in food insecure situations. And that is the outcome of political decision making. So in New Haven, it's just one city in America, but I have just discovered the most amazing level of mobilization by ordinary people on the ground, doing what they can to address the issue of food insecurity, to encourage people to develop greater awareness of food, where it comes from, how it grows, how we might begin to grow it ourselves in cities, and so on. And it's been a wonderfully affirming experience living here and talking to the many activists in New Haven who, you know, really care about sustainability and the right to food and to healthy food for all people who live as citizens here.
Dr. Mary Corcoran here. I just want to make sure that our listeners know, well, ideally, it's well worth, friends, considering if you have, if you can jig around your schedule on this next Thursday, November 15th at 5 in the evening. You will actually, you're as a professor of sociology at the National University of Ireland, Maynooth, and the Fulbright Scholar 2018, the visiting scholar Quinnipiac, people will have an opportunity to not only hear what you have to say, but actually, you know, find out, and perhaps this might be a two-way street with your background and your research. Maybe this is an opportunity for people to, you know, to talk to you about their experience, their perception of what it is. It's called What's Food Got to Do with It, and the Role of the
Yeah, Masters. What's Food Got to Do with It, So I'm basically just looking at, you know, what has food got to do with the modern city, and, you know, does it play a role in sustaining and in social justice in the city? And I'm delighted to give this talk and to meet as many people as I can who live in the New Haven or Hampden areas, because there's actually quite a big Irish-American community settled in the Hampden area. So, yeah, it's on next Thursday at 5 o'clock on the Mount Carmel campus of Quinnipiac University.
Okay, we are going to post details on our Facebook page, I'm told.
Brilliant.
And so it's Irish Radio. That's it on Facebook. And, of course, since all of our archives all of our interviews and programs through the years are archived, today's will be as well, and if you can log on to get information. Indeed, and this, by the way, is taking place at the Center for Religion at Quinnipiac University's Mount Carmel campus, and that's about it. You can get information, you can register by contacting IGHI, as in Ireland's Great Hunger Institute, at qu.edu. Again, Doctor, we look forward to seeing you. And again, I acknowledge, of course, that Quinnipiac continues to do a great job there. Good luck to to you.
Thank you very much. Thank you so much, Adrian. It was great talking to you.
Thank you. Thanks again. And friends, you are listening to Irish Radio Network, UFA.